Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money on RN Summer. And as you probably guessed, today we're looking at movie economics. And the first thing to say is that they are weird, but not as weird as they used to be. You might have heard that saying that for every 10 movies from a Hollywood studio, 7 would lose money, 2 would cover their costs, and 1, just 1, would make it. But it would make so much that it would pay for everything else. Matthew Lieberman's a director at PwC in Los Angeles. Matthew, was that true?
It was fairly true, and it actually may have been a little bit worse than that. Although the profitability of films was much more easily predictable back then. Now, with the advent of newer digital distribution technologies, the whole model has been turned upside on its head, and it's increasingly difficult for most movies to either get produced and or to make money if they are released.
Right, so it's actually harder these days.
Much harder. There's a lot more competition, not only from U.S. film studios, but within territories around the globe, there's a huge infusion of local language content. And films that used to make a ton of money in some distribution channels, such as home entertainment, think of DVD rentals or sales, are in a very challenging environment that have been decreasing since 2008 consistently. So where you used to be able to rely upon those revenues to cover the cost of a film, that's no longer the case.
So how have the studios responded to this?
The studios have really looked at the composition of films that they're releasing. Whereas many of the studios used to release 20, 30 films per year each and upwards, they've really contracted the amount of films they're producing. And they're really looking at the budgets and genre of those films. So as you may have noticed over the past couple of years, franchise films, which are the big blockbusters, have grown significantly in popularity. And some of those are what is generating significant revenue for the film studios. The ability to make money on these films is something that is quite unique because there are often multiple releases, spin-off television franchises, and unbelievable revenue that can be created from consumer products. So think sheets, TV shirts, cups, mugs, all of those types of items.
So blockbusters, but not blockbusters like Gone with the Wind or Cleopatra. Actually, blockbusters might not be the best word.
Franchises is probably the best word.
Jeff Spross is the economics and business correspondent at The Week.
Movies that can easily be made into sequels, movies that are based on a previously known product, Transformers, all the Marvel Avengers movies, any comic book movie whatsoever, the rise of Star Wars once again. They made, you know, another Indiana Jones. I know they've always been talking about making more of them. I'm not sure if they'll ever get to that. But the movie business has essentially been taken over almost by that sort of product. You really do not see standalone dramas or standalone ideas as the major tentpole films the studios try to produce anymore. They've really been displaced.
Fox on the Run by Sweet. It, along with a lot of other 70s hits, features in the next franchise movie coming your way, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I'm no Jason DeRosso, but the first one was pretty good, and it was very, very profitable. The movie cost $170 million to make, and Marvel spent another $70 million on marketing. But it generated almost $750 million at the box office. And nearly 3 years after it came out, it's still making money. Matthew Lieberman.
There's also an interest by consumers to watch that content over and over again. So that is something that is very unique, whereas a lot of traditional dramas or comedies that might be a one and done in terms of viewing, these are ones that consumers want to continue to watching over and over again. So they may be willing to pay either a small amount on demand to watch it when they want or to subscribe to some streaming service in order to have access to the film or television shows. So the life cycle of the content itself extends much further.
And as you heard earlier, that isn't all of it. There's spin-offs, consumer products, toys. No wonder we're going to get another helping. From Marvel's point of view, there could be a long way to go. After all, The Fast and the Furious, a franchise which, even if you haven't seen, you still understand exactly what it's all about, is about to release movie number 8.
The Fast and the Furious movies, for example, I mean, this is big cast, very action-oriented, lots of explosions, lots of special effects. The international box office for Fast 5 was twice as large as the domestic box office, three times as large for Fast and Furious 7. It made over $1 billion just internationally. And the theory seems to be that big, simple stories that either involve lots of action and adventure and explosions or, you know, big robots or fantasy epics and sword and sorcery are just, you can market them easier internationally. They are the kind of thing that can cross cultural boundaries easier, that, you know, you tell some complex drama about American politics or about a particular subculture in American life, it might be harder just to translate to international audiences.
There's two parts to this. One is the rise in importance of the international, and by that I mean non-American market. The other is what's happened in the US.
Movies are competing with a lot more forms of entertainment than they were mid-century. They're competing with the internet. They're competing with YouTube. They are competing with, you know, 500-channel cable packages. And TV has, I mean, I think no one can dispute that, like, TV in recent years has been a lot higher in quality in terms of production and storytelling and all those sorts of values. So movies just, they need to market themselves a lot more aggressively. And there might not be quite as much a need in the domestic market for big action, but using a known franchise product, again, like a comic book or a toy line or something like that, certainly helps them out a lot. The need for recognizable stars is much greater, so those stars can demand more. So you've had several things change in the domestic market that have also pushed them towards bigger budgets.
Jeff mentioned stars. The biggest of them are making astronomical sums.
Forbes magazine has released its list of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, and Iron Man star Robert Downey Jr. has come out on top yet again. Give us a breakdown of this year's list.
Well, as you just mentioned, Robert Downey Jr., the star of Marvel's popular superhero franchise, earned the most money this past year at an estimated $75 million, making him the highest paid actor for the second straight year.
Actually, he was the biggest earner the next year, too. Indeed, for playing one character, Tony Stark, stroke Iron Man, in the 3 Iron Man movies, as well as 3 Avengers movies, it's estimated he's earned at least $150 million and perhaps as much as $300 million. Ridiculously, that could be money well spent.
The purpose of a movie star is to get people into the movie seats. They are a marketing tool. You know, it's a strange thing to pin down, like, the exact nature of cultural appeal and a movie star appeal, like, in an economic sense. Firefighters are, a lot of people would think, are a lot more crucial to society than a movie stars, but firefighters are paid, like, you know, your standard middle-class wage. Movie stars are paid through the roof, at least the most important ones are. And that kind of speaks to this ephemeral quality of, like, why is Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man something that just millions upon millions and upon millions of people will plant themselves in theaters to see. And so that's something that studios want to capitalize on, and they will pay for it. And the other thing to remember is that every movie star, especially of a Robert Downey Jr. sort, is really the face representing an entire army of lawyers and agents and all the rest of it. And they're all very well-paid professional white-collar workers in big cities with high costs of living, and they want their incomes too. So there's just a rolling dynamic that's just, you know, go in and bargain with the studio for as much as you can get for, like, any star to appear in a particular movie.
I have a mansion, forget the price. Ain't never been there, they tell me it's nice. I live in hotels, tear out the walls. I have accountants, pay for it all. They say,
this is The Money on RN Summer with me, Richard Ady. Today, movie economics. You've just been hearing about the stars. They are critical to the opening weekend. It's not as important as it used to be, but it sets the tone for how the movie will go. And social media means it sets the tone in real time.
It has been proven that social media has impact on people's movie-going attendance. even during the first weekend. So it used to be a film released, you saw a commercial on television beforehand, and then we get results back in the next Monday morning to see how the film released. Now, with a variety of social networks such as Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and others, we can actually show that positive or negative sentiment around the enjoyment of the fans can directly impact Saturday, Sunday, and beyond. And that's very scary for these studios right now. And the studios now all have analytics teams that are working on adjusting marketing based on the social media and other online feedback that films are getting.
The studios can quantify the social media reaction and put the numbers into a model that gives them a likely profit level. They have a lot at stake. Making these big movies costs $100 million and up. To minimize the risk of that investment not being returned, they spend another $40 to $50 million on marketing. So, at opening weekend, they're in for $150 million and they don't have anything back. Where are they getting that money? Matt Pressburg is the film business reporter at The Wrap.
It varies. A lot of times what you'll see is they will bring on these financing partners, often from China, sometimes from the Middle East. And so they'll try to, instead of putting up the whole production budget up front, they'll try to find other partners to share in a little bit of that side. But a lot of it is it's money that they have. These big tentpole blockbusters, they are able to marshal resources. When Warner Brothers does, you know, a DC Comics movie, they're able to put up the $100 million plus that it takes. But a lot of times you are seeing definitely an increase in these co-financing deals, especially with international partners that want to get a little exposure to the business.
But that money comes with strings attached.
Absolutely. When you bring more chefs in the kitchen, it's harder to make the meal you want. You don't have full control over that. And so, yes, so when you bring in four or five co-financing partners, it is a little more complicated. But what we're seeing with the studios is they really feel like it's worth it. And there are some regrets. I mean, I've heard from plenty of studio executives who they'll bring on a co-financing partner. The movie becomes a huge hit and they regret the fact that they didn't take all the upside. But in this era where they're really trying to minimize risk and trying to eliminate those really big, embarrassing flops, it's a trade-off they're willing to make.
A lot of the external money these days is coming from China, and a lot is coming from the finance sector. Matthew Lieberman.
The model has changed in terms of these are primarily now financing facilities that the studios have that are now funded by large financial institutions such as private equity or hedge funds, which are providing this money to the studio in terms of slates. So a package of, let's say, 10 films in a given year.
How long has that been going on, Matt?
That's been going on really since 2008 when the economic crisis occurred, because a lot of the traditional funding sources stopped funding film because it is a very risky investment. There is potential to make money. There are always going to be winners. It's a very sexy business to be in, so a lot of high net worth individuals like to be able to get an executive producer credit on the film. But it's been about 5 or 6 years now, and we don't see it slowing down at all.
This is The Money on RN Summer, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. They're the Sapphires, and we're talking about movie economics. The Sapphires, which came out in 2012, was an Australian success story. As I'm sure you're aware, Australian movies don't have budgets anything like those in Hollywood. Cass O'Connor is a professional investor and company director. She's also a partner with Goalpost Pictures, which made The Sapphires. So, Cass, where does the money come from?
The money comes from four main sources. There's what we call soft money. I'll go into that. There's debt finance. There's equity finance. And there's pre-sales. So that means going to international markets when your film is still an idea and trying to pre-sell that film to distributors and sales agents overseas. The soft money is primarily government money.
What's the government money?
There is federal government and state government money, as you'd understand. The state government money is primarily to attract productions or post-productions to that state. The federal government money is primarily tax-based, and there are three different streams. There's the producer offset, which is the ability for a production company to get a rebate of up to 40% of the spend that's made in Australia. Then there are another couple of incentives from the government. One of them is It's called PDV, I think, which is where post-production takes place, regardless of whether the film's produced. And that spend can be rebated up to about 30%. And then there's an overall location offset or location incentive for international films to come and film in Australia. That's about 16.5% of the budget.
How important is that, the money that comes from the government?
Oh, it's very important. It would be very difficult in Australia to make feature films without that. Australia does not have the studio system like the United States.
Right. Would it be possible or not?
I don't have any examples to hand of any feature film being made without that government incentive. I mean, some smaller films are made with crowdsourced funding and, you know, possibly just with some state funding, but it's pretty important.
And the producer offset, which gives a filmmaker 40% of what they spend in Australia back, but only after the movie's made, is particularly vital.
The offset was devised in order to allow the production companies to retain some equity in their product. So before the offset was there, there was still some government money. But what would happen is that a producer would pretty much pre-sell all of the international territories before they got their film made, which meant that if the film was a hit, they didn't have any equity left in the film because they'd already pre-sold the territories. Whoever they pre-sold the UK to took all of the box office from the UK. So the federal government, and I was involved in this, tried to work out a structure whereby the producers could retain equity in the film. They didn't have to sell off all of their rights in the beginning. And then, you know, for films that do well, or even for some films that do, you know, mediocre, the producer can grab some revenue and that will finance a sustainable production business.
Cass O'Connor says the funding model is working. About 7% of films in the cinemas are Australian, and they get about 4% of the box office. She says that's reasonably high compared to recent years, and of course we don't make the blockbusters and the franchise-based hits. All the same, it sounds like being a film producer in Australia is tough. How hard is it?
Really tricky. It's a very long process from your first concept until you see the film on the screen. 7 years on average?
7 years?
Yeah, 7 years.
And is that from having an idea or seeing a script? Or
that's from seeing a script.
So someone's already put the years into writing the script.
Correct. So your first script to on screen is an average of 7 years.
And is most of that about securing finance?
Well, the producer's role is to secure the finance, the cast, and the right crew. But yes, finance is integral to all of it.
So they need nerves of steel and to be prepared just to get through it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the number of films that have been made where finance has dropped out somewhere during the shoot is terrifying. It's terrifying for the producers. It happened to Goalpost on the Sapphires. A funder dropped out while they were shooting and they had to scramble.
But that, you made it. It's been a huge success.
Yeah, that was a great film. That was a great film. So, you know, there are successes.
The Sapphires cost about $10 million to make. That's a pretty good budget for an Australian film. But in the US, as you were hearing earlier, studios are pinning their hopes on the $100 million plus juggernauts. So what's happening to the smaller picture? Jeff Spross.
One answer is there's just less of them. They're still getting made. They will still show up at awards times. They're just not being made in the same quantity. A few different things you see happening. One is that a lot more directors or writers or both who get their start doing like small, independent, more artistic or grimmer work, then get picked up by the studios to try to produce these big superhero, comic book, etc. epics to try to separate these big tentpole movies from the other big tentpole movies. I mean, Christopher Nolan made Memento, which was a tiny little movie about a guy with short-term memory loss and a crime thriller and that sort of thing. And then he gets pulled in to make three Batman movies. So that's one thing that goes on.
Another thing that's going on is that Silicon Valley is moving into the content business. Matt Pressburg from The Wrap.
You're seeing, especially Netflix and Amazon, they're looking at movies in that sweet spot. You know, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, these are movies that are sort of these mid-budget movies that it doesn't always make sense for a Warner Brothers or a Disney or a Paramount to finance, but Amazon and Netflix have basically unlimited money. They can go spend $10 million here, $15 million here, with the hopes that, you know, a couple of them may be successful, but they'll get some prestige. And their motivation is really to drive people to subscribe to their platform. So they don't care as much if the individual film is profitable. Their motivation is different.
So are these tech companies, with their lean and hungry cultures and propensity for disrupting existing industries, a threat to the Hollywood studios?
I think it's more of a change as opposed to a threat. I think Silicon Valley, where you're talking about Netflix, Amazon, these resources, they're obviously, they want to be these huge entertainment conglomerates. They want to be as big as these studios, but they're working with a lot of experienced people, and they're not trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. When Amazon goes ahead and buys Manchester by the Sea, they're not trying to necessarily start from scratch. They're investing in experienced actors and experienced director and kind of being hands off, putting up the money and definitely leveraging their distribution platform. But they're working with Hollywood. They realize that there are only a handful of bankable actors and directors. And as movies spread around the world, there are only so many names that you can count on to deliver each and every time.
Not every studio observer is as sanguine about the tech companies. But if you think about the internet, what it enables is much easier distribution. If you start a new newspaper now, you don't need a printing press, a transport fleet, or a retail network. You need journalists, and this is the hard bit, a way of getting people to buy journalism. You don't need distribution. And it's sort of the same for movies.
That is definitely something I can envision. And we're seeing studios even now taking another look at windowing, where it's you have a movie that comes into a theater, and there's a set amount of time before it can be released onto video on demand, and to pay TV and so on. And so what we're seeing now is with people wanting it, you know, at home, everybody has their Netflix and Amazon accounts, a giant TV at home, and they want to watch their movies. They don't want to wait 3 or 4 months to see a movie that's, you know, already been out of the theater. And so we're definitely seeing pressure on that in terms of maybe closing that gap. We have one of our big cable providers, DirecTV, has a program where they actually have taken some independent films, premiered them on their service before they even go to theaters. So we're definitely seeing technology companies with these distribution networks try to find ways to deliver movies to people faster.
So this could lead to us not going to the movies, but having the movies come to us?
What we're seeing now is and sort of kind of tied to the economics, but some of these big special effects heavy blockbusters like a Rogue One or like a Doctor Strange, where it really does add a lot to see it on the big screen in 3D with the sound. So you're seeing studios try to differentiate themselves by releasing these kind of movies that really do draw you to the big screen. But you're right. Certain movies, maybe a historical drama of some kind, not every movie necessarily needs to be seen on the big screen. And that's the threat to cinema owners.
Matthew Lieberman from PwC says there's already a change in how films are released.
So in the past, a film was always released theatrically first and then went through what we call various revenue windows. So that would include home entertainment and pay television and free television, etc. Now we're starting to see films that are released prior to theatrical release. And that is a very big change to the model, and one that has actually upset in the U.S. many of the theatrical exhibitors, because they believe that all films should be released exclusively in the theater first. The benefit to these smaller films is if they can get a bit of buzz from online presence, then that is actually free marketing for the film, and then it may enter the theatrical market subsequent to that online release. So we've seen a few tests of these over the past 2 years, and some of them have been quite successful, so we're expecting to see more of that in the future. Whether or not the traditional model as it currently stands exists in the future is a big question mark for many. There have been a number of discussions around whether or not this theatrical window, which is the time that the theaters get it exclusively, will be able to exist in its current form.
Hollywood's movie market is being squeezed. In America, people are not going to the cinema in the same numbers they once were. It also faces competition from television, which is in the middle of a golden age. And as everything converges on the smartphone screen, movies become just one among many distractions available at our fingertips. But in Australia at least, Cass O'Connor is optimistic.
Yeah, I am. I think that the new technologies are going to allow filmmakers to hone their skills and craft good films, you know, with smaller budgets, which is what they need to do. The whole world is looking for films which have relevance, which have impact, and always for lower and lower budgets, which is tricky. But the one thing technology does do is allow those budgets on that side of it to decrease. I think there's a great bunch of filmmakers coming up, and they have been for about the last 10 years, who are more business-minded and business-oriented. I'm not taking away from, you know, any filmmakers of the past decades, but quite a few of them, I think, will admit themselves that they were much more focused on the art than on the financial outcomes. And I think the imperative to have a sustainable business is now ingrained in all, you know, film students from the film schools and, you know, most of the industry today. So, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about it. But, you know, it's a bit like a labour of love. It's not like you're going to get paid a huge amount of money for it, unless you come up with some sort of hit in the film arena. The hours are long. There's a lot of negotiations to do, but you do get to go to great parties and film festivals.
In the US, the business model based on blockbuster franchises works very well for a young and mostly male audience. But Jeff Spross from The Week does wonder about its durability.
Another thing that is worth wondering is just how long this current trend can continue. They're already pushing for more people who have not already broken into the public consciousness to helm more expensive movies and just focus on other aspects of the movie to sell it, again, because they can't afford to pay their key star $50 million. So one thing to ask is, how long can this continue? What breaks? What ultimately gives in terms of the studio's business model where they have to try something new and switch gears, and what comes next? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but it'll be interesting to see what opportunities that breaks open.
Okay, let's put more of a timeline on it. What does Matt Pressburg, film business reporter at The Wrap, see in the next 5 years?
I think we'll see a lot more English-speaking Chinese stars play very prominent roles in tentpole movies. China's obviously a huge market for Hollywood. Every studio seems to have a production partner there. The Chinese box office is a big part of when they underwrite the financials for different movies. And so I definitely think that Chinese stars that have appeal at home and also global appeal can handle a lot of the English language dialogue. Their profile will definitely go up dramatically. And we're not going to see a lot of Chinese villains in movies either.
Thanks to Matt Pressburg from The Wrap, Jeff Spross from The Week, Australian film investor Cass O'Connor, and Matthew Lieberman from PwC. You'll find details on our homepage at abc.net.au/rn. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineers are Simon Branthwaite and Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Adie.